I'm Aaron Ross Powell, and this is Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical freedom. Today's episode is about transgender rights and the growing cultural backlash on the right against the very idea of transgender identities. My guest is Kelly Wright, a Brooklyn-based writer and activist and an affiliate with the Center for a Stateless Society. We explore the myths and objections the conservatives have about transgender people, gender-affirming healthcare, and the greater prevalence of transgender identification. We look at how treating transgender people with respect and acceptance and giving them the healthcare they need improves lives and lowers suicide rates. We dig into the nature of gender identity and what it means for self-expression. And we tie it all into the cause of liberty, which means nothing if it doesn't support and embrace the right of everyone to live lives and express identities of their own authoring. Maybe let's start with what might be a pretty basic question, namely, what is gender, and is it distinct from biological or, I guess, assigned at birth sex?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think the answer would be yes and no. It depends on the context that we're speaking in. I think rhetorically, people will do sort of like a bait and switch where they'll say, well, we're talking about gender, which is a social construct, which can be changed, which is different than biological sex, which is an immutable fact. And I think that for intense, like for argument's sake and for really the lived reality of a lot of people, there really isn't a difference between the two. For instance, many trans people have their sex markers changed on government identity documents. A lot of trans people have a biological sex that would be closer to their lived sex than the one that they were assigned at birth. So I think from like a, maybe like a 101 level, yeah, there's a difference between gender and sex, but for terms of law, and when we're talking about public policy, I think a lot of people kind of conflate them or maybe like they don't conflate them for purposes of like controlling trans people specifically.
So then just conceptually, like what does it mean to say, you know, my biological sex assigned at birth is male, but my gender is something else? I mean, is that different than saying, you know, because we all have identities that are different from each other's identities. What is specifically then kind of the identity of gender in this context?
I would say, like, I think that the phraseology of like assigned at birth is very important. I think that that language is more accurate for one. People they're born and the doctor basically looks at their groin and based on what they see, they assign their sex. So they're basically assigned male or female. And that is essentially the beginning of what is a gender caste system. And it's not always correct. Some people grow up to change their sex. Some people, their sex at birth really doesn't have much of a bearing on their day-to-day life later on. I would say like gender is, this is like the kind of postmodern where postmodernism kind of enters the conversation. Gender is sort of like a performative thing that people do irrespective of their assigned sex at birth. So you can think of gender as sort of a way that we signal to others how we want to be perceived. And again, that doesn't really have anything to do with what someone's sex was at birth, what they were assigned at birth. I think it's more accurate to describe gender as like, there's no one who's 100% their gender presentation, their gender identity is 100% male. I think it's like a spectrum, right? There's people not it's not black and white. I think we're progressing into a future where the gendered expectations of people based on their assigned sex are getting looser. People are, you know, there's more permissiveness entering into our cultural awareness. And I think that's a good thing.
Now, this might be getting ahead of ourselves because there's a question later on about transhumanism and, you know, where things are headed. But does this mean that transgenderism, as we understand it right now, is a temporary thing in the sense that we have these existing conceptions of gender roles? And so the thing that people object to is people of different biological sexes essentially transgressing in their minds these gender roles. But as that spectrum grows and we become more diverse, does gender as a binary category, I guess, disappear? And we just kind of perform our identities however we imagine them, without saying this identity fits with this conception of biological sex or this traditional gender role?
Yeah, that's, I think about this a lot too. I would say, I'm not sure. I think that it's an interesting hypothesis to think if in some future state where like today's contemporary or maybe the past century's contemporary gender roles are more or less like a thing of the past. But the question would be like, would people still experience like gender dysphoria in such a future? And I wonder if maybe fewer people might experience that sort of like discordance between how people perceive them and how they perceive themselves. So I wonder if in, you know, 100 years, if we had a kind of a more relaxed understanding of like gender and we divorced it from biological sex or sex assigned at birth, I wonder if there wouldn't be so much, you know, if the resisting that, I think you use the term transgression. I think that's a great term, especially like, yeah, that's just a great term. Like we're kind of refuting this system that's kind of taken for granted, and our very existence kind of throws a wrench into this system that has been created. And I think that that's what's really kind of scaring a lot of people, a lot of the more reactionary minded people, is if something that was taken to be so safe as like sex, if that can be upended, then I think that that has implicated what else can be upended? What other things are we taking for granted? And I think that that can be unsettling for people.
Does that then mean that, because I was going to ask about how, you know, people have lots of identities. We perform lots of identities, you know, like every kid goes through a goth phase kind of thing. But like those identities don't seem to be as upsetting to conservatives and a lot of libertarians as gender identities and transgressing specifically gender identities is. And so I guess one thing that I wondered was how much of the almost visceral negative reaction to transgender identities and people that we see on the right isn't so much about sex and the questions that they raise, like, you know, like, well, if you're born a man, you're a man, and there's, you know, like trans women aren't women and all that. It's like this very kind of categorical, definitional, biological thinking. But how much of that is just a broader pretext for, we've seen even before transgenderism became the big issue that conservatives are upset about, there's always been this long, like, you know, women should be working in the home. That's their tradition, or should be in the home. That's their traditional identity. And men should be the breadwinners. And that broke down the sexual revolution, you know, women increasingly in the workforce and men losing out on manufacturing, like all of that, like that, how much of it is less about these biological categories that we're told it is and more about like just reinforcing the roles that conservatives think men, however we identify them, and women, however we identify them, belong to in a society?
I think they're related. So I think that ultimately it comes down to a concern over reproductive capacity. And I think that kind of informs a lot of the gender caste system I was referring to, like keeping women in the kitchen, keeping women in the home, raising children, and then men go out and make all the money. I think that that is about like it emerges from like a centuries long process of like viewing women as property of their fathers until they're bequeathed to their husbands to be the property of their husbands. And I think that that's kind of where that system is decaying and dying, and where the new system, the new world is, you know, struggling to be born. And I think that that's kind of where we find ourselves. I do think that this, the concern seems to be with a lot about like reproductive capacity. So you see this in a lot of the, like, the books that have come out targeting like trans acceptance viewing. It seems to be really couched in like paternalism and protecting the reproductive capacity of, it seems to be really focused on like young trans masculine individuals who they would argue are just young girls. And a lot of that, they see them being like basically being told to hate their femininity and become men. And that is something that we need to protect them from. And then on the flip side, they view trans women as like invaders or fetishists who are preying on her, trying to enter women's spaces to prey on them. And to bring it all, like, to bring it all together, it just strikes me as like a paternalistic urge to defend the like sanctity of femininity. And yeah, I think especially in the context of like trans women, the transgression comes up again, because that is a lot of the cultural like animosity is really directed at people in like the trans feminine spectrum. And it's because they, like, we voluntarily revoke like male privilege. We voluntarily kind of, we, why would anyone want to embrace femininity? Like, our culture views femininity as like weak and humiliating and passive. So why would anyone go like forfeit that? And so, yeah, I see it as a concern, like, it's kind of like the state seizing the means of reproduction, in a sense, saying that your body really isn't yours. It serves a sexual function of procreation, and any attempt to disrupt that should be stopped, whether that's abortion, whether it's contraception, whether it's same-sex relationships, or whether it's gender transition. It all comes back to controlling like reproductive capacity, promoting the nuclear family by law, promoting a procreative nuclear family, and really eschewing any kind of like self-determinism or self-ownership, people deciding what they want to do with their own bodies.
A lot of the current debates and really heated arguments and what I think we both agree are quite dangerous laws that are being passed right now have to do not with, at least explicitly, not with the mere existence of transgender people, but instead with giving people transgender healthcare, and particularly children, although that age, the age that they count as children, seems to keep going up. So what is the healthcare that is in question? And is there a concern, is there a legitimate concern about young people who maybe are still in the I'm exploring lots of identities phase, getting medications or treatments or even surgeries that, you know, that they're not in a position to have decided, you know, in an informed way, or that they're going to, you know, regret when they become adults?
Yeah. So I don't think there's that much of a risk. I think implicit in that assumption is, like, I think speaking from personal experience, when I came out in like 2014, my main concern was like doubt. And I think that that's a concern, or what's on the minds of a lot of people who are just starting to come out, is this doubt. And so I think a lot of people who are embarking on a gender transition, there's no fast lane. No one is really being like rushed into a medical transition. So I really don't think it's that much of a concern. In terms of like children, I will just say, like, I think maybe the most important thing I want people to really take away is just this idea that transgender identities should be seen as just as authentic as cisgender identities. And what I mean by that is, it's pretty well documented that gender identity begins to emerge in people as early as the age of 2. And it starts to like concretize and solidify and not really change by the age of 4. So, and this is true for cisgender children and transgender children. So, and again, like if someone is 4 years old and asserting that they're a gender different than the one assigned at birth, they're not being prescribed any medications. They're not getting any surgeries. Generally, what it looks like is talk therapy with an adolescent psychologist. They might embark on what's called social transition, which is really just picking a new name, growing your hair out, or maybe cutting your hair, changing the clothes that you wear, choosing different pronouns, and seeing how that feels, seeing if that makes them happy. And so I think, you know, the earliest you really begin introducing medical transition would generally be with the introduction of puberty blockers, which again would happen around the onset of puberty. And I think that we can say that I think that we are at a point in our technological capabilities where people can choose the puberty they want to have. And I like framing it in that way, because that's like ultimately what we're talking about here is like puberty blockers are a tool to kind of prolong the decision-making window, to delay the onset of irreversible bodily changes. So they're a tool for prolonging the period to make life-altering decisions. And again, like another point I really want to make is that a lot of this care that is offered to transgender people wasn't designed for transgender people. It was used for cisgender people for decades. Puberty blockers are used in precocious puberty cases, people who are starting puberty young. And some cisgender people take hormones. I guess like to bring it in for a landing, like I don't really think there's much of a risk. And I think that the concerns about rushing people into transition are unfounded. And again, there's this, we have to keep in mind the broader context that we're living in. Like we live in a very gendered society, and the status quo, the prevailing systems are designed to affirm the genders of cis people. So, you know, kind of like creating space in this system for trans people isn't like tearing the system down. We're really just in the beginning of this rethinking. I think it's a good thing.
So when I've had conversations about this with people who take a more conservative, say, position, or in some cases a more reactionary position on these issues, the concerns that I hear with what you just said, the reactions that they have or the pushback are a couple of things. The first is that due to what they would phrase as, you know, like the kind of the woke culture around this, which they say dominates, you know, at the academy, but it also dominates now in the schools and so on. When a kid or a preteen comes forward and says, "I think I might be transgender," and they're talking to a teacher, or maybe they're talking to a psychologist or a therapist, you know, they're talking to someone, an adult, that there's the current culture of radical acceptance, I suppose, has them not then having a conversation about, are you in fact transgender? Is this in fact your identity? But instead that it's all affirmations, like, okay, you've said you're transgender. Now how can we affirm this identity of yours and then proceed to the therapeutic steps that you just mentioned, or the kind of proto transition steps that you just mentioned. And so a lot of kids are naturally like fickle in their identities. They play with identities all the time. They get caught up in fads and so on. We're basically, the argument goes, we're like, our culture has us just reifying those potentially fickle positions instead of saying, let's try to decide if they're genuine or not. Is there a worry about that? Is there anything to that concern? Like, should we be saying to the, you know, whether it's the 7-year-old or it's the 11-year-old or it's the 14-year-old who says, "I think I might be transgender," or should we be saying, "Okay, yes, now let's figure out how to explore that"? Or should we be saying, well, wait a second, let's talk through whether this is genuine, for lack of a better term.
So I think the two choices you're providing, the closest to reality is the let's go slow method. And I would say every major medical association in the country recommends gender affirming care. It lowers suicides, it lowers depression rates, it lowers anxiety rates. Every major medical association supports it, and for trans youth, for adolescents. And the diagnostic criteria, the terms that are used is kind of like a buzzword, is persistent, consistent, and insistent identification. And that is like a perpetual identification. This is different than, say, you know, small children identifying as dogs and cats and engaging in like fantasy role play and that sort of thing. It's just completely different. We're talking about completely different things. Back to my earlier point, like, gender identity emerges very young in people, and it's kind of and apart. It's like it's its own thing. And when you, if you're lucky enough to be born to a family that is accepting, and you're lucky enough to be in an area with the doctors and the endocrinologists, and you are lucky enough to get an appointment through the wait times, there really isn't, like, they're not forcing it on you. If anything, there's pumping of the brakes along the way of checking in and saying, like, how do you feel? One thing I wanted to say is there's this like prevailing notion that like trans outcomes are bad outcomes. Like if someone, there's this idea that if someone who is cisgender thinks they might be trans, starts on the path of like a medical transition and then decides it's not for them, that is kind of seen as like this humiliating, it's seen as like, I don't know, there's like so much like consternation around the possibility that someone might think they're trans, take some steps to pursue that, decide it's not for them, and that is just like a horrible outcome. And I think that is just like, I think we should encourage people to explore that part if they're questioning. But again, like, there's really, the gender affirming model is different than what I think would be called like the gender reparative model, which is generally how it was done before, which is basically conversion therapy. If like someone who's assigned male at birth comes forward and wants to grow their hair out and then, you know, express their gender in a feminine presentation, they're advised to, like, their parents are advised to like throw out girls' clothes and make them play sports and, you know, like, really like push it, right? Push the cisgender outcome. So yeah, I just, realistically, the way that it's playing out now, the gender affirming model is like the way to go. And it's the way that like trans people have advocated for, the people who are actually pursuing this care. It's deviating from the gatekeeping method where you have to go in front of psychiatrists and kind of like prostrate yourself before them to get hormones. We're moving away from that, and we're moving towards this informed consent model. And that's kind of where I think the fight is going to be, is this informed consent model. And even for like adults, this is the fight that's going on in like Britain, is this fight over self ID and saying that like in Britain, I'm pretty sure you need a government gender recognition certificate to like amend certain documents. And that's just such a horrible idea in my mind, like needing the government's permission, a government permission slip to like recognize your sex or your gender. It's just so, I'm so hostile to that. And I think we're kind of importing that, like we're importing that transphobia, that TERFism, this like reactionary mindset. And I'm not pleased. And I think we should be going the route of like informed consent and, you know, approaching it with an open mind and helping people through what is kind of a tumultuous point in their life.
What about the role of parents in this? Because one of the big objections, and you know, this is part of the Florida Don't Say Gay laws and so on, is this notion that kids are telling their teachers that they think they might be transgender, and then the teachers are affirming that and helping them explore it, and it's being kept from the parents, who obviously have an interest in what their kids are up to, particularly if it involves like medical decisions. And And sometimes it even kind of shades into almost talking as if kids are talking to their teachers, getting sent to the school counselor, and then beginning transition, even in like a, you know, taking hormone blockers or taking puberty blockers or taking hormones, all of that happening without the parents, which seems the schools probably aren't giving puberty blockers to children without.
That's not happening.
But like what is the role of parents, and should parents, should this kind of stuff be able to happen without parental input or outright consent?
So I think that that's like a tough question. I come from, I worry about giving parents all of the power. I don't believe that children are like the property of their parents, and that their parents do make like medical decisions on their behalf. But I do think that like the idea, like in Florida, this like Don't Say Gay bill, I believe it's like called like the Parental Rights and Education Bill, and lost in a lot of this talk about, you know, like gender affirming care being child abuse, and Texas sending child protective services after families who are pursuing care recommended by all the major medical associations, where the parental rights of parents of trans children seems to be lost in this. There are a lot of families in Texas are like frantically trying to leave the state to avoid child protective services, not only removing their trans children from the house, but their siblings, like their non-trans children, saying that like you're an abusive parent and you can't have your children. It's just like, it's hard to believe that that's where we're at right now. But I think like in terms of like parental rights, like I worry about trans people who are born to non-accepting parents. And I do think that there's something to be said about people having authority over their body and at that age, at the age of say puberty. Like recently Bill Maher was remarking on his show about how there seems to be more trans people in California than Ohio, and why it seems to be so localized, and not understanding that like, yes, Ohio is considering a bill right now to criminalize gender transition, to literally criminalize it up to like the age of 25, which is not trans youth. And like, I'm reminded of Leela Alcorn, a transgender girl who committed suicide in the Dayton area, which is where I grew up. And in her suicide note that she published to Tumblr, one of her calls was for like early childhood education on gender identity. And like, yes, like there needs to be like, people need to be aware that this is like an option, that there are people out there like them. And I would hope that as things get more accepting, parents will support their children in pursuing this much needed life-saving medical care.
Yeah, I mean, this makes me think of how the frustration that I have with a lot of libertarians who, you know, libertarians are way out in front on gay rights and gay marriage. You know, the Libertarian Party was the first major party to put gay rights in their platform. The libertarian think tanks were the first pushing this in Washington way before Democrats and progressives got on board and so on. And yet, when it comes to transgender rights and transgender just acceptance or even just toleration, how many people who were good on gay rights suddenly are very bad on this, but in a way that mirrors the same bad arguments about gay rights that they pushed back on? And what you said about accepting parents is, you know, is part of that, is there are a lot of gay libertarians who went through the experience of having an unaccepting family, of being ostracized, of just wanting their identity to be validated and accepted, being told that they were abnormal or shameful or outside of acceptable behaviors and identities, and how much better the world became when being gay was just treated as normal. You know, like it's just one way to, you know, to be. But then when it comes to transgender stuff, they are making exactly the same kinds of, like, we have to protect the children. This is about predators, kids are being forced into these identities by woke or leftists. Why is it different for people? Like, why is gayness, which is a way of expressing your sexual interests and sexual identification, and people don't seem to draw the parallels there.
So, yeah, I think there's a lot there. I'm not sure why. I think maybe some differences might be that sexual orientation is like more invisible. Like, it's not, you can't like really tell by looking at someone what their sexual orientation is. And early on, you know, the concerns were like, I'm okay with gay people as long as they don't flaunt their lifestyle. And I think with trans people, it's like a little more obvious if someone comes and changes their gender. And like, if it's a coworker or a family member, it's like, it's more identifiable, easier to spot. I also think that we're kind of behind the curve. So I think a major part of growing acceptance of like gay people was convincing or teaching the general public that like, you have a sexual orientation too. You're just heterosexual. We also have a sexual orientation. We're just homosexual. And I think once the broader society is like, oh, they're just like us. They just like people of the same sex. That's fine. And I think part of that was like, oh, cool. Now like, we'll accept them because they just want to get married and have kids and be, again, part of that nuclear family, which is great if you want to do that. I think with trans people, it's like, there's more of like an obligation on other people. So this is like where pronouns come in. Like if someone at your job transitions and they want you to use different pronouns, people might be defensive and think that that's like an expectation of them that they might want to not comply with. And beyond that, I think it's also like, yeah, the ick factor. I think some people, especially as a result of like decades of conservative fusionism, that is kind of the social conservativeness has kind of seeped in subtly. And it's seen like gender nonconformity is seen as like maybe juvenile or not serious or threatening to like the nuclear family, the patriarchy, that sort of thing. So that's my suspicion of why there might be behind the curve. But I don't know. It's frustrating.
The pronoun thing has always struck me as a little bit odd. Like people get really mad about people asking them to use different pronouns. And on the one hand, like you can understand, you know, you've referred to someone as she, pronouns are kind of baked into our language. We're used to using them. We're used to visually identifying people as getting a certain set of pronouns. And you can, you know, so it's like an extra level of like friction. You have to think about this in a way that you maybe didn't before with a given person or keep track of it if, you know, with multiple people and all of that. But like the rage about it, people often change their identities in ways that require us to change the language that we use around them all the time, whether that's I've changed my name or I'm, you know, like I'm going by this nickname now, please call me. I had a friend who had one name and then in seventh grade, he went away for a year to live on a houseboat in the Caribbean. And when he came back, he had a different nickname. And he wanted all of us to call him that. And some people did, some people didn't. And it was, you know, like it, but like people do that. Or I've converted to a different religion. And so now I need you to act. Maybe
or you get married. Someone was Miss and now they're Mrs.
Right. We do that all the time. And people still, you know, like you can slip up and call them by the old thing. And then they just say, hey, you know, like, could you please call me this? And you say, oh, I'm sorry. And, you know, like this doesn't seem like a big deal. But the pronoun thing just creates this like rage where it's not just, I'll try to remember to do this. It is like, this is a personal affront to me that you are saying, hey, can you call me she or they instead of he?
So I think a lot of it might have to do with the sort of like the caste system. Like we live in a very gendered society. And I think cis people in particular don't really identify it because it's like trying to tell a fish that they're in water. We're just swimming in it all the time. And so when people start to point out how gendered our society is, people can get defensive. And like, I think it's, I like through my transition, I obviously started like maybe degendering my language and trying not to use gendered terms so much. And I just find it to be easier. Like maybe at first it's a little tricky. But now I say like folks and stuff. And like, I don't know. Like I don't, I really try not to use gendered language when it's not necessary, which is like most of the time. And yeah, I encourage, I don't know. It's, it comes so much easier to me now and it feels more accurate. Like, it feels more encompassing.
In the notes that we had put together before this conversation, you drew parallels between trans rights and abortion rights. Can you discuss that a bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're recording this like what, a week, 2 weeks after this leaked Roe decision, which I think is kind of, if that opinion comes down the way that that draft is written, it would be probably like the single most anti-libertarian moment in the Supreme Court's history, maybe. Like in terms of like, in all of our history, we've been expanding constitutional rights. Like we've been reinterpreting the Constitution to extend rights to more people. And if this decision comes down, not only would it limit the right to an abortion, but it would just completely eviscerate the so-called unenumerated right to privacy, which so many other constitutional rights rest on, like the right to have a same-sex relationship in your home, or the right to use contraception, or the right of interracial marriage. These all rest on this unenumerated right to privacy. And, you know, I've been kind of steeped in like reading about abortion rights the last couple weeks. And I'm just struck by the connections, like even for like cis people, like now that states are criminalizing abortion, like Oklahoma just basically criminalized abortion after fertilization, which I want to say is before conception. So the interpretation of that law could criminalize like IUDs or the morning after pill. But now that states across the country are going to be restricting abortion, maybe in all cases, a lot of people are like, well, I want to get like my tubes tied now. Or I want to get like a hysterectomy. And like cisgender women are, there's so many stories on Twitter of cisgender women wanting to get their tubes tied or to otherwise end their ability to get pregnant. And doctors are just like, no, like you might regret it. Do you have children? Like you don't have children yet. I'm not going to do it. Or I need your husband's permission. I'm not going to do that without your husband's permission. So I see like the right to change my sex as stemming from like the same bodily autonomy, like tree of liberty. And yeah, like that just goes kind of like across the board. Like, again, we talked about this earlier, but like, it does seem like the state is just very preoccupied with ensuring that people, you know, grow up, get married, have children, and that's it. And the push to criminalize abortion is part and parcel with the push to like if you really push these people, like I call them at this point forced birth proponents, if you push them, they seem to think that like pregnancy is like a punishment for having sex, and like if you don't want to be pregnant, you shouldn't have sex. And so implicit in that is that like non-procreative sex is wrong. And if you go further from there, then what do they think about people who would get their genitals reconfigured? What would they think about someone like there's already questions around like Texas is considering criminalizing people leaving the state to get abortion care. And so then you start to wonder, like, are they going to like people who are having miscarriages are being denied the care they need because of this. And I don't know, like the idea of someone, I mean, I go to the doctor and nurses will ask me if I'm nursing or pregnant. And I tell them no, obviously. And I just wonder, like, in some future state where abortion is criminalized, like, what stops the police from, like, inquiring about, like, menstrual history or inquiring about, like, the state of your reproductive capacity? And I just really wonder, like, what, like, the future we're heading into is just really disconcerting. And it seems to be the uniting thread between them seems to be like a concern around fertility
a concern around reproduction. And I think, yeah, I think it's wedded in there with like great replacement theory, which has been in the news lately, this fear of like declining white births. And yeah, I see them connected, and it's very concerning.
I think there's too a fear of essentially, I call it like radical self-authorship, the ability of people to choose who they want to be and how they want to express what they are and the kind of life that they want to lead. And this is why I'm increasingly, you know, part of the argument for fusionism, for the compatibility of libertarianism and conservatism, is that you can have conservative values and preferences, socially conservative values and preferences, but believe that government should be extraordinarily limited, and that, you know, the institutions propping up freedom, and that there can even be like a synergistic relationship between those, where, you know, the freedom that a minimal government gives us allows us the room to cultivate, develop, habituate virtues of a conservative type, which are then, those virtues are then necessary for the continuation of a free society. And so much of what's going on right now, including the backlash against transgender identities, I think plays into it, or puts the lie to that, I suppose, that it's not enough to simply say, I believe in a minimal state, or I believe in freedom, but I have very traditionally conservative views about gender roles or the place of women or the proper types of families or expression, because at some point, you know, I've heard from people that it's not that, you know, we're anti-gay or we're anti-trans. It's just that, like, we, you know, it's Hollywood's pushing it on us. They keep putting gay characters in my television shows, and I'm sick of seeing them. You know, they're like, they're ramming it down our throat in very suggestive language. Like, it's, I think that there's the broader problem is that ultimately conservative or reactionary virtues, call them, or values or preferences, when a society is sufficiently free and people are expressing themselves in all of these ways, ultimately become incompatible with even political liberty, which I think what we're seeing right now is like, oh my God, there's all these people transgressing gender roles and I don't like it. And so now freedom goes out the window. And so I increasingly think the only way to maintain a genuinely free society, defined in part as one where people have the freedom to self-author, is for a critical mass of the polity to not just have a belief in political freedom, but to have internalized, habituated in culture and like actual liberal values and virtues in terms of not just toleration for difference, but appreciation for difference, delight in difference and self-authorship, an affinity for cultural dynamism and identity dynamism and so on. Because I don't think, if you don't have that, I think eventually the political stuff is, you're going to turn against freedom. And I think this is what we have seen among a lot of libertarians who are descending into right-wing stuff. It's what we're seeing with the rise of these anti-gay and anti-trans bills, is just there's a lot of people who are like, okay, we've crossed a line, society's drifted too far from my particular lifestyle preferences. I say I like freedom, I celebrate the 4th of July, wave the flag, but it's time for the state to step in and, you know, criminalize or outright destroy the lives of the people who are living in ways that make me feel uncomfortable.
So yeah, I think you're right. I'm reminded of Friedrich Hayek's Why I'm Not a Conservative. And I probably won't get it verbatim, but I think the overarching thesis there is that conservatives fear like a liberal order or fear freedom because they don't know, they can't anticipate like where it will lead. And that liberals are fine with that. Liberals think that like the dynamism of the liberal order is, yeah, it's unpredictable, but it provides so much innovation and so much enrichment for everyone that's like we have to support it if we value freedom. And I'm also reminded of like this argument that you just made about like, you know, if we let people just do what they want, then it'll degrade. they won't support libertarian policies. And that seems, that's like, I think that's like almost exactly like what you hear from like anti-immigration libertarians, where they say that like, we can't have immigration while we have a welfare state, or we can't let immigrants come here because they'll vote anti-libertarian positions. And that's just like, I don't know, nonsensical to me. So yeah, I think like, I want to shout out like Deirdre McCloskey, who's written a lot on like liberalism and the great enrichment. And, you know, she cites like loosening gender roles as a win of the liberal order. That's a good thing. The fact that people is Jordan Peterson, like, is he really saying that like the good old days when women couldn't open bank accounts without their husband's permission is like what we should go to? Like the Stonewall riots, which really kind of kicked off, I guess, like the gay rights movement in 1969. And a few years before that, there was called the Compton Cafeteria riots. Those were anti-police riots. And they were anti-police riots because police were enforcing cross-dressing laws. They were like arresting people and taking them to jail for women were wearing pants. And, you know, people who at the time probably identified as like transvestites, who we would call trans women, they were being arrested for wearing dresses and wearing makeup. And that was an ongoing like persecution of those communities. And eventually they just like, they literally rioted. And that was the beginning of like, of gay pride, gay power. And so, yeah, there's like, you know, going back to your point about like libertarians being ahead of the curve, like, yeah, I think they put same-sex marriage in the party platform in the early 70s. And I believe when Hillary Clinton ran in 2016, that was a year after Obergefell, when the Supreme Court took it away as a political issue. But like Obama and Clinton were defending the Defense of Marriage Act on the floor of the Senate in like 2008. So like, I don't know, like, yeah, we are progressing slowly but surely, and there appears to be blowback. I'm hoping we don't regress too far, but yeah, I think you do need to stick to your libertarian principles and realize that some people might do some things that make you uncomfortable with their freedom. And that could include like literally physically changing their body. And that if that makes you uncomfortable, I think that says more about you.
So then what is the consistently libertarian or genuinely liberal position on transgender rights, given some of the concerns that, you know, conservatives or libertarians have about children or making, you know, medical decisions that at some point might be irreversible? From like a libertarian policy perspective, how should we be approaching this?
So yeah, I have a lot of ideas. I guess like the first one I would say is like there seems to be a trend from like Democratic legislatures lately to add like an X gender marker to government documents. And I think the consistent libertarian position would be just to remove gender markers from government documents. I'm reminded of a story in a book that maybe libertarians might like. It's called Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? It's by Heath Bogg Davis. I believe he's an attorney at the ACLU. And I believe that book opens with the story of Philadelphia's gendered public transit passes. And this is an interesting case where it seems weird to think about it now, but like in the 2000s, Philadelphia, in order to combat fraud, that was their stated purpose, to combat fraud, they put gender markers on their bus passes. And this obviously created headaches for people, specifically trans people. There's a case of a trans woman who would basically be denied access to buses, no matter which gendered pass they provided. So they carried like a male pass and a female pass. And again, this is for trans, like a mass transit system. And I think if we can, and this person with the ACLU sued Philadelphia and won, and they removed their gender markers. And I think if we can concede that it's bad for there to be gender markers on metro passes, I think the logic applies to driver's licenses and birth certificates and passports. Like, why can't we just remove it from them? So that's one thing that I would say. I don't think testosterone should be a Schedule II substance. The DEA considers it as a Schedule II controlled substance. And I think I think that that should be descheduled. I think that access to sex hormones should be liberalized, whether it's through a doctor or otherwise. One thing that I think that libertarians could push that would make them arguably like further to the left on this issue would just be like, informed consent should be the standard of care. Like, the alternative to the informed consent model is you basically have to get a therapist or a psychiatrist permission to start hormones. And states and localities are, you know, removing that gatekeeping step of having to like go to often cisgender psychiatrists and therapists who have their own ideas about gender. And the way that this played out in like the 1900s, if you were a trans woman and you wanted access to estrogen and androgen blockers, they like required you to live full time in your desired gender presentation before you could even access hormones. So they're like forcing people to like, you know, dress the way they want to dress, but without access to the like physiological alterations that come with it. And so you're kind of like, they were like making people like targets, because that inhibits their ability. Like their physiology doesn't change, right? So I would like to see a more widespread adoption of the informed consent model. And I do think that if you're distressed by the idea of going through your endogenous puberty, I think that you are of sound mind to decide not to go through that puberty. And if you're 12, I think that that's true. I think that that's true in that case.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kelly Wright. Now, here's a preview of the next episode of Reimagining Liberty with Jason Kuznicki on the thought of the French philosopher and historian Michel Foucault. Foucault often gets ignored as a leftist by liberty advocates, but his analysis of the ideology of power and knowledge offers powerful tools for critiquing the state.
I wouldn't say that Foucault is a Marxist. I don't think the category fits very well at all. To a Marxist, all of history is the story of class struggle and the story of the implications of class struggle. So when you look at the 19th century, what you see if you're a Marxist is a story of the proletariat in conflict with the bourgeoisie. And for a Marxist, eventually the proletariat is going to win, and they will do away with class distinction and make a society without arbitrary domination or oppression by capitalism. And Foucault is, in a way, a bit more pessimistic than that. He doesn't believe that history has that kind of endpoint to it. History remains always one damn thing after another. And if you think that there's a way to get out of power, to escape the power relations that structure society, you're probably missing something, or you've probably actually bought into one or another ideology that is not going to deliver what it's promising. He's in a way both multi-causal about historical events, but also not teleological about the direction of history.
Reimagining Liberty is a listener-supported show. Become a supporter and you'll get all episodes 2 weeks early, as well as access to our Discord community to chat with me and your fellow listeners. Just click the link in the show notes or head to reimaginingliberty.com/subscribe.